From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. The South Dakota Department of Game, Fish, and Parks Commission established hunting seasons back in the 1900s. This measure allowed deer populations to recover from historic lows. The practice continues to this day, and if you've lived in South Dakota long, you know deer hunting is what November is all about for many South Dakota outdoorsmen and women. Now, this weekend marks the beginning of the whitetail and mule deer seasons for those living West River. So to celebrate, we invited Ben O'Brien. He is the writer, editor, and the host of the Hunting Collective podcast, a member of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Board of Directors, and Meat Eaters Director of Hunting. He sat down with SDPB's Joshua Heyer.
First, I want to start. Thanks for coming on the air. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me.
So you've been out whitetail hunting all week, I understand, right?
Yeah. Just landed back in Montana from a full week of rut hunting in Michigan on our property, Meat Eaters property.
How much land do you guys have out there?
We bought a 64-acre farm about 6-7 months ago, and with the idea that we would hunt it for whitetails, of course, but manage the whole thing for biodiversity. So we have a show out about it now called The Back 40 on the Meat Eater YouTube channel, meateater.com, and we're just tracking the progress of the property from start really to finish. That includes, you know, bird surveys, pollinator surveys, biodiversity surveys, planting food plots, hanging tree stands, and then finally the very much anticipated whitetail hunt this last week.
And how do you guys go about laying out your land? So like, you know, we're going to put a shelter belt here, tree line here. Who's all involved in that process?
Yeah, so Mark Kenyon is our resident, we'll call him a whitetail guy. He likes that description. And he's from Michigan and managing the property for us. And really, unfortunately, or I guess fortunately, depending on how you look at it, this year we didn't really start work till August. Usually you'd want to start looking at planting food plots and getting things, doing any hinge cutting or mowing or anything you need to do with a property way earlier in the year in June or July. But until we got it purchased and had a management plan put together, it was August. So this year we just put in whatever late season food plots we could, took survey of the land, mowed a bunch of trails, and really just kind of took stock of the property. But I think normally you would be planting those food plots earlier in the year, starting to do any hinge cutting or any other types of improvements that you want to do. But the property that we have here, the back 40, is pretty raw. It's got a lot of old fields that haven't been improved in very long. It's got a lot of really tall cover and in the form of goldenrod and mare's tail, which is big, long weeds. So we got a long way to go with this one, but it's exciting to kind of just see it from the beginning.
Have you had any luck yet?
Yeah, we actually, 2 days ago, no, it would have been, yeah, 2 days ago, when you're whitetail hunting 12 hours in a tree every day, you lose the days sometimes. But a couple of days ago, Mark, who I mentioned was managing our property and the host of our show, killed a buck we call the Wide Eight. It was the only real mature buck we had seen on the property through all our trail cam scouting and all our time on the property. So Mark had named him the Wide Eight. I mean, he's an old buck, maybe 6.5 years old or 5.5 years old, which for Michigan is ancient. And finally got a chance at him. He came under my tree stand in the dark 2 days ago and headed towards Mark's tree stand. He was able to grunt him in from 100 yards away. He came charging in check out what was going on, and he got a shot. So, I mean, it was for all the work that you do on a property like we have, or any property, really, it was a relief and a celebration. And you'll see, if you go to the media, YouTube, and watch the show that'll come out here in a couple of weeks, it was pretty emotional for Mark because he worked his butt off to get to where he is.
Well, we definitely have a lot of fans of the show. And I think the big question that when I was talking to a lot of people was they wanted to ask you, what does your process look like, I suppose, for like getting ready, picking a spot, gear, those sorts of things?
Yeah, I mean, specifically, you know, for deer this time of year, there's a lot of things you think about where you are. Just specifically in Michigan, early in the season, you're looking at, you know, food to bed, bed to food. You know, I know in Michigan, October is the opener, so you're really looking at those travel corridors, trying to get in a pinch point or a funnel and set up there and hope that you can funnel a buck through in his kind of normal route whether he's going to bed or coming out to feed. And so that's normal. And, you know, the process really involves, you know, as much scent control as you can manage. Mark Kenyon and I have a few disagreements. He's a little more anal about it than I am, but you got to understand, you know, scent control, understand deer movement, understand what they want at that time, and then kind of how they're conditioned. And we, and this also on this property, tried to provide as much of a sanctuary for them as possible. So we, there's a big swamp in the middle of the back 40, and we tried to stay off it as much as we could and tried to make sure that these deer, you know, felt safe, felt secure, so they could take up residence in a place where we're going to be hunting. So that was a big part of our process this year. And then it's just making sure you have enough tree stands in different spots on a property, or, you know, no matter where you are, so you can play any wind direction. You can slip in unnoticed, if possible, and make sure you just have a lot of options. So we, you know, Mark and myself also spent a lot of time hanging many tree stands and making sure that we knew kind of like, hey, if we got a south southwest wind, this is what we're going to do. If we got a northwest wind, this is what we're going to do, and making sure we could stay nimble.
And a lot of that seems to go away when you hunt public land, a lot of that control.
Yes, yes, it does.
So have you ever made it out to South Dakota?
I do. Yeah, man, I love South Dakota. Yeah, I've hunted South Dakota once for deer and a pile of times for turkeys, probably, I don't know, half a dozen times for turkeys, and shot a bird in the Black Hills this year in April, so, or no, in May, I believe it was. So I love South Dakota. Love the Badlands, love the Black Hills. You know, now being kind of neighbors, is I guess a word to say here, living in Montana, it's an awesome place to go and to hunt whatever you're after.
Yeah, we definitely have some diversity of land. I mean, really good pheasant hunting, whitetail hunting's nice. And then on Chamberlain River, there's some really good hunting. And then you get out to the hills and it's a whole nother game from what I understand.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, the hills is a whole nother game. There's cool, you know, the one of the cooler things that I always think of is there's spots in the Badlands that I've been where you can hunt mule deer and whitetail kind of in the same time. You know, you can spot and stalk them, get up high. It's unique in a lot of ways to find whitetails and mules in country like that. So I think South Dakota, and as you mentioned, pheasants, I remember a couple of times coming into, I believe it was Hecla, South Dakota, and hunting pheasants and thinking this is the Mecca, and it's the place to go. So well advertised, but it's not wrong. I've never had a bad time pheasant hunting in your neck of the woods.
So I think one of the things personally, like Meat Eater has symbolized and done a lot for hunting, is specifically kind of the culture and conversations around it, as far as the ethical argument for hunting, taking responsibility for the meat that you eat. How do you approach or talk to people who may have a negative perception of hunting? What is it that you say to somebody?
Yeah, I actually, on my podcast, The Hunting Collective, I endeavored to find an animal rights activist and a vegan to have on my show to talk with, and people I knew I would have pretty diametrically opposed to their views and vice versa. So I did that. And I think what I ended up learning from that process and maybe took a little bit away from it is, you know, everybody relates to hunting on a different level, right? So there's so many levels in which I relate to it, and, you know, meat being usually the easiest one for folks to understand, right? Everybody, most people in this world, unless you're vegetarian or vegan, are eating meat on some level. And so that, you know, you can start there and start talking about that. But there's deeper meaning in deeper levels of hunting. I'm a big proponent. I'm sure everyone else listening to this that's hunted or heard of Meat Eater, I'm a big proponent of our model of conservation. I think the North American model of conservation is essentially an equation to an end, and that end is more wildlife, more healthy populations, better ecosystems, better habitat, better diversity, and it's worked over, you know, many decades past the turn of the century. So that's one where I think you can take, you know, the emotional time spent with loved ones, the skills that you learn, you know, the values that you learn from hunting. You can start with the meat and then say, look, there's this conservation equation that we've created that gets us to the end, which is more turkeys than we've ever had, more deer than we've ever had, more waterfowl, more elk. Moose are doing great. There's black bears in just about every state in this nation. And so all these animals that have been applied to this model have flourished. And hunters not only fund it, but they drive its importance within state game agencies and the like. So that's a really, like I would say, a pragmatic way to speak about it and say, we love animals, and that's the evidence of that is in this model. And most people in this country value and love animals, so it's a nice way to relate it.
Yeah, I was really fascinated once when I learned how much wetland conservation comes from, like, Ducks Unlimited and stuff like that. It was really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, then you have the federal duck stamp that 98% of the federal duck stamp goes to 98% of the dollars from it goes right to wetlands conservation and wildlife refuges. And I mean, it's huge once you really start understanding the history and the legislation. It's really hard to argue against it at that point.
So I hear you guys are actually on Meat Eater giving away a whitetail hunt.
I don't know if I could say that. I could say it pretty safely that I don't think we've ever given away a chance to hunt with Steve Rinella. He's our founder. He's our leader. I don't think within his career there's ever been that opportunity, but when we launched the Back 40 project, we felt that we really wanted to share that with people in the best way we knew how, and the best way is content. But we wanted to kind of buttress that idea with, hey, one person is going to get to come and experience our handiwork firsthand and be able to hunt with Steve and hunt with Mark Kenyon next November 2020. And on the Back 40 in Michigan, the place I just was, and we shot a nice buck. So I'm sure there'll be more nice bucks popping up over time, and that'll be a good chance for folks to go and win a hunt with Steve, which is a pretty rare thing. I've hunted with both those gentlemen, and it's some of the best experiences I'll ever have outside. So I hope everybody can go enter. You go to meteor.com to enter, and for a chance to go and see how well we did with this farm over the next. We got about a year left to get it ready.
So anything else you guys got in the works?
Yeah, season 8 just launched on Netflix. A lot of people already binged it and are asking for more.
So
there we go. They're out there filming it right now. So they're filming season 9 now. We've got lots of things. Our YouTube channel is dropping a lot of the episodes of Back 40. We just launched episode 3, but we have 5 more episodes coming between now and the end of the year of the Back 40. And for those out there that are just thinking about whitetails, we got a whitetail newsletter called Whitetail Weekly that all our content comes right to your inbox every week, every Monday, including the Back 40 and including our giveaways and contests and all our other content from our website. So we're going all in on whitetails for this time of year, and then when the calendar flips to January, we'll probably be out ice fishing. So we'll be checking for that.
All right. Well, Ben O'Brien, we really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Josh, I really appreciate it. Thank you, man.
Most South Dakota towns, no matter the size, has or once had a Masonic temple. The Freemasons are the oldest fraternal order in the world. Jeffrey Larson joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh for images of the past and a look at the history of the gathering places in South Dakota, along with the men and women who sought to better their communities. Larson is an attorney and sovereign grand inspector of the Scottish Rite Freemasons in South Dakota.
Jeffrey Larson, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating history, and before we go into some of the locations and what these temples really served as, it's something that a lot of people don't know about because the Freemasons sort of kept their business close to their chest, not in a secretive way, but in a way that they didn't necessarily go boasting about what they were doing in the community. Tell us a little bit about efforts today to tell people about the history of the Freemasons and also the current activities.
Yes, it started where we were never a secret society, but we were a society that had secrets. And we've just determined more recently that while we certainly do have secrets and still try to keep them despite the internet, that it's best for us to get the word out a little bit about the charities we do and that kind of thing.
All right, so let's talk about the Scottish Rite Freemasons. Give us an idea of what this organization actually is.
Okay, once you become a Freemason, you can join other appendant bodies, one of which is the Scottish Rite. And what the Scottish Rite's main charitable mission is the speech and hearing clinics, which we have throughout South Dakota and throughout the United States and the world. So that's our main thing. And we really we're an extension of the original Freemasons, and we are kind of the University of Freemasonry. A lot of extra thought and study goes into the Scottish Rite.
And these are really community leaders in South Dakota and across the country, but for our purposes, there's a reason that almost every town in the state has a place to gather for Freemasons. Tell us a little bit about the history here in the state of South Dakota.
Sure. Yeah, Freemasons started here as soon as South Dakota did, really back in the 1860s when Dakota Territory was started. And you're right, at one time, almost every little town in the state probably had a Masonic Lodge, or what we call a Blue Lodge, where you became a Freemason. Of course, over the years, just like everything else, some of the small towns have lost those, but there's still many around the state and continue to this day.
And these men are, their goal, you mentioned charitable organizations sort of making a community better, but also the improvement of the self. Is that still a part of what the Freemasons are interested in, is just becoming better people?
Absolutely. One of the slogans is we make good men better, and that's certainly true. You're asked as a Freemason to give serious thought or philosophical questions that the human race has struggled with throughout time, and so it's just a way for men to stop and think about themselves and the world around them and how to be better citizens.
Yeah, which in this day and age is probably a harder sell than it was back. With so much going on, stop, pause, think about what it means to be a good human being and take actions that might help you be a better human being for the benefit of your community.
Which is why I think it's so important.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about some of these buildings and Yankton and this historic building. Tell me about some of the structures. What are they used for, first of all?
Well, the buildings are used for, and mostly in our case, for the gathering of our brotherhood and the teaching of those philosophies. What we do in a Scottish Rite setting is we put on what are known as degrees. In other words, they're kind of like one-act plays, each one giving a new philosophical or moral principle to consider or contemplate. And the Scottish Rite goes from degrees 4 through 32, as the original Blue Lodge Freemasons do the first 3 degrees. And once you complete the Scottish Rite degrees, you are then a 32nd degree Mason. And that's what happens in Yankton and various other sites around the state.
Tell me about the building itself in Yankton, this historic structure that's built in 1901.
Yeah, that's an amazing building in Yankton. It was, started construction in 1901. I think it finished in 1903. What I think unfortunate is how many people probably right in the city of Yankton haven't been inside that building. Mm. And so we are trying to think of more ways to simply invite the public in and have a look at what the building is like. But it's a tremendous structure. We were so good as a society back in those days at building those kind of things, whether they were churches or Masonic lodges or other amazing structures that were built. And it's really an amazing building, and we're doing our best to keep it going.
Tell me about the theater in there, because you mentioned the sort of these degrees and kind of the analogy of a one-act play. This facility has an amazing theater with some backdrops.
Yeah, the backdrops in the building are amazing. And a lot of Scottish Rite buildings have these kind of things. Yankton's are certainly one of the best, probably, in the country. What they have is a number of backdrops, dozens and dozens of backdrops that are priceless. It came to us from Wichita, Kansas, over 100 years ago. And we use those then in the one-act play settings in that third-floor theater up there. So you can have a forest or an Egyptian scene or almost anything you can think of that helps create the ambiance beyond the degree that's being shown to the candidates.
What is it like to sort of participate, to be in that space with all that history and still kind of, be interpreting it for a modern setting, for modern people who are thinking about some things that really community leaders have thought about for so many, since 1900. Really, it has to be somewhat humbling, I guess. Let's start there.
Oh, it is. It's one of my favorite things. Going into the building in Yankton is simply an awesome experience. I live in Mitchell, South Dakota, So Yankton is the place where people in the southeast part of South Dakota go, with the exception of Sioux Falls. And when you first go in there and become a Scottish Rite Mason, you're just amazed by that building. And then to participate in it, as I have for a lot of years now, each time it's incredible. And even though the building is old, and even though the principles and the messages are old, I think they are timeless. And so it's fun to communicate those to new people each time. But it's really an honor to be in that building. There's so much history, so much Yankton and South Dakota history in that building.
Yeah. As you look around at the history of South Dakota, really how much has been influenced by some of, you know, the philosophy of the Freemasons? Can you see, you know, when you look back and read something in history, can you say, yeah, I bet that community leader was connected to this life?
Oh, sure. We've had, Senator Abner, Senator McGovern, former Governor George S. Mickelson were all members of the Yankton Valley of the Scottish Rite. So, you know, those people would have taken that as when they're doing their government civic jobs that they were elected to do, would have understood those principles and held them undoubtedly close to their hearts as they conducted themselves.
How did you get involved in this organization? How old are you, and what was sort of drew you to wanting to participate?
Well, as is so often the case with Masons, not always, but it's common, my father was one. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Vermilion, and my dad had joined Lodge in Vermilion, and then he joined the Scottish Rite over in Yankton. So many, many years later, he hinted that was something maybe I could do. And so I did, and I joined the Lodge, and then I joined the Scottish Rite at Yankton. And that was I joined Freemasons in 1997, and I joined the Scottish Rite in 1998.
Hmm. And how did you notice that it was sort of, influencing you in your life right away? Some of the things that in your personal life started shifting because of these connections?
Well, I think it just reinforces with you things that you probably know. You're probably taught by your parents, to simply be a good and decent human being. But, you know, it's pretty easy. All of us fail at those kind of things from time to time. And it was just another way to remind yourself to how to live your life. I am a businessman, and you do those kind of things. And there's a way to conduct business and a way not to conduct business. And, you know what's right and wrong. But it's always good to have various backgrounds in how to continue to be the right kind of person. And whether it's religious or something else, those all help. And the Scottish Rite and the Freemasons helps with that.
Mm-hmm. Not a religious organization. All religions welcome?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not a religious organization. Okay. We certainly encourage our members to be such. As a matter of fact, you do have to believe in a higher power in order to be a Mason. But any of the five major religions are all accepted in Freemasonry.
Can you give us an example of a degree and what that sort of looks like? What can you tell us that sort of helps put that into a greater clarity for people?
It is oftentimes a fairly straightforward philosophical lesson, shall we say, where you're being taught maybe in one degree that while the workmen, and we often do a lot of our stuff as an analogy to or as a description of ancient Middle Eastern times in the building of King Solomon's Temple. And so one of the lessons might be that while the workmen are working on King Solomon's Temple, that they shouldn't use undue influence against their fellow workers in order to gain some kind of advantage. Or they shouldn't seek to have the judges of Israel to try to influence them and not allow them to be the independent judiciary that they should be. Those kind of straightforward, both civic and philosophical things are what would be portrayed to a person in any given degree, something like that. Mm.
As you spend time in different structures, places where people have gathered and met, what amazes you about some of the artifacts and the history that's left behind that has meaning for you not only as a Freemason but as a South Dakotan?
Well, in both cases, like I say, the history of our state and our nation are in some of these buildings. Scottish Rite has its headquarters in Washington, D.C., in what's known as the House of the Temple, which is an absolutely incredibly stunning building in Washington, D.C., just north of the White House on 16th. When you go in there, you realize that several of our presidents and many of the founding fathers were Freemasons. They have artifacts from those times. And here in South Dakota, whether it's in Yankton or in our valleys, Deadwood or Aberdeen or Sioux Falls, that we also have, the history of this state and thus this country. Many of those people have passed through these buildings. I know in Yankton, there was there was a DeLoss Gurney who was involved in the building of that building. I don't know if he was related to Chan Gurney or not, but, you know, that's a pretty big name in Yankton.
Right.
In Deadwood, Seth Bullock, you know, and some of those characters from back in those days in the Black Hills was a member of the Deadwood Scottish Rite.
Award-winning author, journalist, and radio host Manoush Zamarodi is fascinated by the intersection of technology and brain science, specifically what's happening inside our brains when we get bored. Zamarodi is author of the book Bored and Brilliant, How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self. She came to Northern State University in Aberdeen this week as part of the Common Read. This year's event was supported by the Larry and Julie People Family Endowment. The free lecture was Wednesday, November 13th in the Johnson Fine Arts Center. She joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh before the talk.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. And you're on your way to South Dakota. You're talking about the book, Bored and Brilliant, with so many Northern State University students for the Common Read. And you are one of those early thinkers. Early on, you're thinking about how tech is interacting not only with our lives, but also with our relationships to ourselves and with our brains. Did you feel like you were one of those early people? You were kind of on the forefront of that, and then it started changing really, really fast.
Yeah, there was this moment, you know, 2012, 2013, where everyone was kind of high on the promise of what technology was going to do for us. You know, you could tap a app on your smartphone and boom, a meal or a car would appear, and it just felt a little bit of like magic. But I think it took a few years for people to start to understand that there are costs with being able to have drivers available at all hours, and that these companies, we didn't really understand how they were funded. The fact that when venture capitalists put tens of millions of dollars, invest tens of millions of dollars into these companies, they want to see these companies scale as quickly as possible. And along the way, sometimes humans get hurt. And so for me, you know, some of the questions, I think I was called maybe by a few people, maybe a little paranoid or kind of a downer back in the early years. But I think, you know, now those same people might take it back and say, well, maybe you were, I've been also called a canary in a coal mine.
Right.
So, and I think what's so interesting to me is this idea that technology could so fundamentally change very human things, like how we read or how we parent or how we fall in love, where we work. And that's really why I became so passionate about reporting about technology. And I think now we're at an extremely crucial moment in starting to put rules and understand that maybe just allowing things to progress as they have doesn't work. We need to be thinking about regulation. We need to be thinking about frameworks. And so I think it's going to be a tough couple of years as we figure out how we start to rein things in where it's not working and also lean into the very wonderful things that do indeed come out of technology.
And one of the arguments that comes up right away for some of those people who would say, yeah, you know, don't be a downer, is that another country, say China, is just going to mow forward fast and not worry about some of those things that we are going to spend a little more time contemplating about the nature of the impact of technology on democracy or the ethics of things. How do you address people who say, like, yeah, and we have to stay competitive?
You know, agreed. Absolutely. I mean, I think when we compare ourselves to China, we also need to compare what kind of and question what kind of society we want to live in. You know, that in China, they are using technology to have scores on people's behavior that they measure, that there are ways that people have absolutely zero digital privacy. And those are the things that hold us dear, and that we got to play the long game on this one. I think dismissing our basic democratic rights in the name of innovation and a competitive economy is extremely short-sighted. And I think that's what we've been doing as these companies concentrate so much on quarterly earnings as opposed to longer-term impact on society. We reward shareholders, but we don't reward the actual communities and families and societies that use these technologies. So we gotta play the longer game on this.
Do you think congressional lawmakers have been fully prepared when we talk about, you know, regulations and looking at privacy? Have they understood as deeply as they needed to what exactly was happening in some of these companies? And, you know, how they were using things like facial recognition, the potential for it. How has Congress sort of kept up with what's happening in tech?
Yeah, and I would say it's not just Congress. It's the FTC. It's the FCC, the other federal organizations, where as much as I think they would like to be fully briefed on all of these technologies, they either A, don't have the bandwidth, or B, they don't have the people advising them. So there are very, very few Congress people who actually have a knowledgeable technologist on their staff. Extremely few. There's no budgeting for it. And that's, I get really excited, like places like the Ford Foundation are starting a new initiative called Public Interest Technology, where they are working with a handful of academic institutions to create a pipeline. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, that was the first time we had something called public interest law, where lawyers, you could learn how to be a lawyer and how to apply it to the public good. And what these academic institutions and the Ford Foundation and other players are working to do is create the same thing, that if you're a student who is good at science and math and computer science, or maybe you're not and you are interested, though, in public policy, how can we start to make sure that you you become a well-rounded person who understands how technology impacts society, what the legal ramifications maybe should be, and how do we make sure that those people want to go to Washington or want to go to their state capital to advise advise lawmakers on a local, on a state, and on a federal level.
To the point of the book, Bored and Brilliant, and tying into what you just said about what's happening in technology, obviously a lot of students in Aberdeen read the book. For other people who maybe haven't read it, talk to us a little bit about the neuroscience or the neurology of boredom and what's happening in our brain in that moment where we get a little bit restless and then pick up our phones.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if some people listening are like, wait a minute, she's talking about, like, having technologists on Capitol Hill. How does that relate to boredom?
Right.
And actually, I'm going to try to draw that line for you right now, which is my whole way of getting interested in the ramifications that technology has on us as individuals and as a society was a moment where I was like, wow, I am really struggling these days. In 2014, I was really struggling to come up with creative ideas. And I can only describe it as having sand in my brain is what it felt like.
Yeah.
And so I began to think, you know, all those moments when I'm waiting to pick up my kids or in line for coffee, those moments where I used to just allow my mind to wander and think about things, now I fill them with time with my phone. It's an opportunity to be productive, to text my husband about what we're going to have for dinner, or to check my calendar, to read my email, see the news. And then so I began to question, you know, what if we aren't bored, what could we possibly be missing? Is this sort of human state that we think is something to be avoided at all costs? Is it actually deeply fundamental to us in some way? And as I did research, I began to understand that we activate a particular network in our brain when we become bored. And that network is responsible for some of our most original thinking, for our problem solving, and for something called autobiographical planning. This is actually telling ourselves the story of ourselves. Who are we? What have we experienced so far that brought us to this very moment, to listening to this interview? And where are we going to go next week, 5 years from now? What goals are we going to set? And how are we going to begin to plan out the steps we need to reach those goals? So really, it's like time travel in our brains. And we don't have that extraordinary time traveling mechanism if we're tapping Instagram to see what's happening right this minute. So
right.
I think, you know, it's not an anti-tech book. It's more about understanding more deeply some of the human things that we have not prioritized as we've become such a digital people.
And I want to reemphasize that point that it's not a, you know, throw your phone, you know, into a drawer and never look back, because in some ways there's no meaningful way to opt out of tech in this day and age. You know, from a professional standpoint, most of us are expected to do some kind of, you know, even social media presence. So this is about sort of thinking more deeply about what's happening, why it's happening, and how you can regain your agency. And I want to talk about this idea of, like, do we have any agency? As we learned more and more about how people were kind of mining our data and looking at our digital exhaust and using artificial intelligence and deep learning to predict our behavior, do we have the agency that we think we do when it comes to the digital world?
Oh, Lord, that is the big question. I think that you just completely put your finger on. And I want to thank you for not saying it's a put down your phone sort of call
right.
To action. It's really not. But I think, so I think the Cambridge Analytica scandal sort of, to me, is the event that sums up your question in many ways. This idea that political operatives could gather so much data on us that they know exactly what kind of advertisements to place in front of us to make us feel certain ways and then nudge us to vote certain ways. To be clear, it has never been proven that psychometrics, which is what that field is called, it's never been proven that psychometrics actually worked in the 2016 election. However, we live in accelerating times. Things are moving extremely fast. And for now, really, the only place that we remain autonomous over is our brain for now, until we get chips put in, right? But your phone knows where you are. It knows how fast you're walking. It knows what you're doing. It knows pretty much everything about you. And as you said, to be a functioning human in the world, you probably need to be on it. Certainly as a working mom, it makes my life possible. I can keep, you know, track of where my kids are and make sure they're safe and do my job.
Yeah.
But I think, we are coming to a point where we can begin to understand that putting the burden on individuals and consumers is unfair, because I do believe that we've never lived in an age where technology has been so personalized, where it is able to potentially exploit the wonderful things that humans have, which are thoughts and opinions and beliefs. And we've seen how conversation online often gets perverted in many ways when we take away some of the human things that make a nuanced conversation, like eye contact, like body language, like patience with each other and listening. So I think we're at a crossroads.
Yeah.
Where we have to look to see how how the government plays a role, how we as individuals do the best we can, that we continue to care and don't just say, well, you know, who cares? It doesn't matter if they have my data. I have nothing to hide. Well, that's not the point here. The point is to think beyond yourself and think there are people who, because of their religious affinity or gender or sexual orientation, depending on what society thinks, may indeed be in jeopardy. So we all have to think, you know, it's not just for me. It's a collective responsibility that I think we as consumers need to take, but we need help with that. And that requires, I think, Silicon Valley starting to have a bit of a wake-up call, which seems to be happening. We need shareholders to push back and demand more of those companies. And we certainly need Washington and actually more and more our state legislatures to also make sure that we link arms with them as well.
So let's put these two things back together as we wrap up. This notion of being bored and then this notion of an election and the sort of, you know, the things. Because one of the things that you make this connection so clearly is that part of it is just that moment where you give yourself time to think and consider instead of having a knee-jerk reaction. And no matter who your candidate mm-hmm. happens to be, you need to be. There's big policy things that need to happen, but on a daily basis, like, you need to be aware of this right now. Not mm-hmm. only something basic like the privacy settings on your phone, but when you see something, giving yourself time to reflect before you decide, act, think, retweet, that sort of thing. So tie this notion of in quotation marks, boredom, with what's happening in America politically today.
I mean, I'm a person who likes to move fast. I live in New York City. I like to be doing multiple projects. I am a multitasker, even though I know, like, physically that's impossible. But I really, truly believe we've reached a capacity. You know, I think of that moment when I first got a smartphone and I was on a conference call and I was at the playground with my kid. And I was like, this is amazing. I can be in two places at once. And now here we are, and I'm like, you know what? It's not so great to mentally be in two places at once. One time my kids fell off the swings, and I wasn't really listening to that conference call anyway.
Right.
Humans are linear human beings. We have reached some capacity, I think, at this point. And so I think we need to remind ourselves to proceed at our pace, not necessarily at a computer processor's pace.
Yeah. So we give you permission right now to turn off your radio and think about what you just heard for a while. It's okay. We'll be here when you get back.
We welcomed a leading musician on the Nordic folk music scene ahead of a performance Saturday, November 16th at the Canton Depot Museum as part of the Carnegie Center for the Arts in Canton. Vidar Skreda has an extensive background in traditional music and a master's degree in Nordic folk music from the Royal Academy of Music in Stockholm. His recordings have been honored at the Norwegian Folk Music Awards and the Finnish Grammy Award. He joined Lori Walsh for A Moment in Sound.
Where did you grow up? Tell us about your childhood.
Well, I grew up in Norway, on the west coast, born in a place called Nordfjord. But when I was 5-6 years old, I moved to the south of the west coast, to a town called Haugesund, which is between Bergen and Stavanger.
Tell me your first musical, like, how did you become introduced to music as a child in Norway? What's the first music that you hear as a little boy?
Growing up, it would be a lot of fiddle music in Nordfjord, actually. On the National Day, 17th of May, they used to have like a parade where all the fiddlers gathered and would walk. That's the first memory I have of fiddle music. And my dad played fiddle, so I got some exposure there too.
Yeah. Did he play in the home? Did he play out in places? What was that
Both.
Like?
Both. Or, well, yeah, you can finish your question there. Sorry.
No, I mean, where did you see him play? Was it something that you heard around the house, I guess, or was he a professional musician?
Mostly around the house with my dad, yeah.
Yeah.
But we did have a few gigs together when I was a kid, like in the community house and stuff like that for Christmas.
Yeah. When do you start playing?
That's a good question. We had like instruments laying around in the house, so I was goofing around on most of them. I played in a mandolin orchestra when I was 13 years old, but when I was 14, I started playing the haranger fiddle, which was the first instrument I chose to learn by myself. So I said I became serious when I was 14, and from there, yeah, I've been playing traditional music from my home area since.
Yeah. Why traditional music? What appeals to you about Nordic traditional music? Because you could play European classical music, you could play rock music. I mean, you could be all kinds of different kinds of musician, and this is the area that you're drawn to.
Yeah, true. That's a hard question. Well, I guess some of it is my dad's fault. Well, he kind of was into it himself. And another reason can be that it's you can assign some identity to it, being you know, your home area tradition. But in the end, it's just like any other music. It's music that I enjoy, and it comes natural to me to play and perform. So, and it's a social, you know, type of music too. You get to meet others, play with others.
And as you get deeper and deeper, you study. Finally, you're studying at a very high level the history of traditional music and folk music and Nordic music. It has to be fascinating enough for you to make not only a career out of playing, but an education out of learning about it. Tell me a little bit about your education and some of the history that you have studied about the music that you play.
Well, I started off having my own fiddle teacher or a fiddle master, Lærermeister. Teaching master, directly translated. Her name was Siri Dyvik. So she started me off on the tradition I play the most, which is from Rogaland, my home county, Rogaland. So I went to her for my five first years, from 14 to 18, 19 years old. From there, I goofed around, or not goofed around, but I played around with a lot of other musicians making bands and stuff until I ended up doing a bachelor degree in Oslo for Norwegian folk music, Haranger fiddle as main instrument. After 2 years, I jumped into a master program and an inter-Nordic joint master program between let's see, this is complicated. The Sibelius Academy in Helsinki, Finland, the Royal Academy of Music in Stockholm, and then the Carl Nielsen Academy in Denmark, Odense. So I had half a year in each of those, which led me to get stranded in Finland for 7 years. What was the other part of the question?
Just wanted to know a little bit about, you know, the education. And maybe we can take a break from talking and play a little something.
Sure.
And then when we come back, you can tell us about this instrument because it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And interesting to behold. So we'll describe it for radio listeners here in a minute. But what would you like to play for us, do you think?
Yeah, okay. I'm going to do a traditional tune from Bjerkreim in Rogaland. It's called Gammal Springar, which means old springer. Yeah, that's his name. And it's after a fiddler called Ivar Fuglestad. So here it goes. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Let's talk a little bit about this instrument that you're playing and how it's played, the style in which it's played. Mm-hmm. Start with the instrument itself. Tell us about this fiddle.
Yeah, so it's called Hardingfele in Norwegian. In English, it's quite often called Hardanger violin or Hardanger fiddle. I like to call it just Harding fiddle in my own English. it came around my brain just got stuck. Baroque, in the Baroque, sure. Period, where people experimented more with how they built instruments. So one of the features is that they put a lot of sympathetic strings on instruments. You have instruments like viola da mora and that family, which this fiddle is related to. You have the nyckelharpa in Sweden, which also has sympathetic strings, and the hurdy-gurdy with sympathetic strings. So it was like and I think a bunch of other strings also just had a lot of extra strings on them for fun, I think. So this one came around in that time.
So how many strings does this have? Because there's some on the there are layers of strings.
Yeah. So this one has the, as the regular fiddle, it has the four top strings that you play on, the four melodic strings. And under the fingerboard, it has, today it has like four or five extra sympathetic strings. It goes through a sub-layer or sub-level on the bridge too, so under the fingerboard. And so it has, my fiddle has then five extra pegs, so 9 pegs in total on my fiddle.
And it's just gorgeous. This particular instrument with its inlays and its, I don't know if those are etchings or, but the decorative aspect of it. Tell me where this instrument came from.
This one is made by a luthier called Magne Straume in Dala, just close to Bergen. this is a more modern take on it. The earlier fiddles were more bottle shaped and a little bit smaller, and they might only have like 2 sympathetic strings, under strings.
When you hold the bow, you hold it differently than what I would see at a symphony concert. Tell us a little bit about the bowing style.
Oh, yeah. So I'm taught to hold down like the classical style down here. But I have small hands, just like our president. and I'm proud of it, by the way. Some say it's a Baroque hold, but to me it's mostly physics, because the bow actually has its balance point kind of a third, like up here, third way in. So when I hold it closer to that balance point, it actually puts less pressure on my pinky and my other hand. So I think it just naturally glides up there, so I can relax more. Down at the end, my hand gets stiffer. I like a relaxed hand.
So all you students out there, it's okay to make some adjustments so that for your own comfort.
You don't want this to get kind of locked up when you play. So, but if you can hold it all the way down, then you have more bow, so it's preferable. But yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about this music in America right now. And Bill, I want to bring you back into the conversation. There's a real interest and a longing to not only preserve in Nordic folk music, but to hear it performed live here in the region as well.
Yeah, there is, not too much in the Hardingfele. You don't see that much around in South Dakota. In Minneapolis, they have a club, I know, up there, and there's more players up there. But there's some Nordic music around in South Dakota and around the area. I play quite a bit myself, a lot of Danish music, and some Swedish and Norwegian. But it's great stuff, and it's just I also do a lot of historical research where I live in Canton. And an interesting note, I found an article in 1902 paper from Canton where they brought in a concert of a Hardanger violinist who was fairly famous, and he had a Halling dancer with him. The traditional dance they do in Norway, where the hat dance, where they kick the hat off the broomstick. So I thought that was interesting. So it's been around, and you know, a lot of this music is dance music now. Mm. For example, like the Springer, that's a dance, right?
Oh, absolutely. Right? Yep.
Vidar, is that a couples dance or is that a?
Yeah, that's actually the first couple dance ever coming to Scandinavia from Poland and Germany back in the days.
So Springer.
That's yeah. I can tell you more about that if you want.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So Scandinavian fiddle music is unique by the oldest. So the oldest fiddle music you find in Scandinavia is the Springer or the Polska, which is the Polish dances. Polska is basically a reference to Poland, mm-hmm. Polish dances. And Springer is the German term of the same dance, Springtanz, running dance, basically. And it was revolutionary because it was the first couples dance coming to Scandinavia. Before that, it was all chain dances or circle dances.
Okay, sure.
So you weren't alone with your partner. So it became a hit, and it came along with a promenade leading into the running dance. So it has like a promenade part, walking for a bit, and then faster music would start, which was in three, and in the 3-beat measure, which is the Springer or the Polska today. Yeah. So
I'm always fascinated by fairy tales and folk tales and stories from Scandinavia. Is there an intersection between story and music in a way that there are songs that sort of reference, you know, something that connects with a fable or a folktale?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Tell me a little bit.
Well, one side of it is the all the supernatural, mythical creatures that like music, like the trolls and the Huldra people. The devil, basically, some call them. So you have tunings that is more preferable for that type of music, and you have tunes connected to like the underworld people. So there's that part, and a lot of tunes is also just have stories or texts going along with them, which describes some fairy tales and stuff like that too.
Yeah. It must be fascinating to read, you know, to be studying at that level and kind of find out a connection. Yeah.
Another thing that I've read a lot about is fiddlers going into trances. That was a big thing where they would be so concentrating and playing music. I mean, I've read these books about this stuff in Norway where they would say they'd actually have to pick the fiddler up and carry him out because he would go into a trance and he'd be transported. And that was pretty common where they would talk about that kind of thing. So it was, and also that a lot of the music they got from nature, from a waterfall or from a, and one of the most famous tunes that I would know about, or maybe people here would, Fana Chulin, which was about the devil.
Yeah, Fana Chulin, that's the devil. Yeah,
and the fiddler was Müllergutten, the miller's boy.
Yeah, he was over here.
Was he?
He was one of the first national romantic, or the first revived kind of fiddlers that got to tour all over the world. He came to America.
Really?
So there's a ton of folk tales and mythology and all that kind of stuff connected with it.
Mm. All right, what will you play for us next?
Well, I can do the second part of this, the oldest fiddle traditions. So I'll do the promenade part, a gangar type, or this in this case it's a Halling. I'll do it from the same region just to stick to a theme here. So it's going to be a Halling from Bjarkrei, same fiddler. Thank you.
It wouldn't be an arts and lifestyle podcast without it. Here's poetry from Studio 47.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is David Wojan. Wojan was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, on August 22, 1953. He grew up in the Twin Cities and enrolled in the University of Minnesota, where he graduated with a degree in English. He then attended the University of Arizona, where he received his MFA. He taught at Indiana University for many years, as well as other institutions like the University of Chicago, the University of Houston, and the University of New Orleans, before joining the faculty at the Virginia Commonwealth University, where he is the director of the Creative Writing Program. His many books include Ice House Lights, Glassworks, Late Empire, The Falling Hour, Interrogation Palace, and World Tree, to name a few. Wojan has won 3 Pushcart Prizes, the Yale Series of Younger Poets Prize, a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation, and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. He lives and writes in Virginia. Today's poem is The Assassination of John Lennon as Depicted by the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, Niagara Falls, Ontario. The title, while long, is also absolutely vital, because without it, a reader wouldn't really understand what is going on, at least not initially. One of the things I really like about Wojan's work is how he focuses on moments in popular culture. This poem is a perfect example of that. John Lennon, as I'm sure you are aware, was assassinated on December 8, 1980. A deranged fan, whose name I won't say here, approached him as he and Yoko Ono were entering the front door of a building called the Dakota. It's where they had their apartment. I was 10 years old when this happened, and when I was growing up, the Beatles were always playing in our house. My parents loved their music, and my Irish mother even got a chance to see them in concert. This happened in Belfast at the King's Hall in 1964. She was in the fourth row. Even though she was only 20 feet away from John and Paul, she couldn't hear what they were singing because of all the screaming around her. As for my American father, he loved their music too, and to this day, he still listens to the solo work of George Harrison. On that night back in 1980, I remember sitting on the carpet watching Monday Night Football. My father was on the couch behind me. The game was interrupted to mention what had happened and that John Lennon was dead, aged 40. My father was very quiet after this. He seemed to drain, and I could tell that something was very, very wrong. "What happened?" I asked. My father gathered himself and went over to his record collection, where he picked out Sergeant Pepper and brought it over to me. He pointed at John. "See him, this man here? He was killed tonight." I'm not sure exactly what happened after that, but I do remember the outpouring of grief in the days that followed for this man, for this musician. It left a mark on me, I guess, as it has on many others, including David Wojan. What I like about this poem is how he talks about memory and commemoration. This is The Assassination of John Lennon as Depicted by the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, Niagara Falls, Ontario, by David Wojan. Smuggled human hair from Mexico falls radiant around the waxy O of her scream. Shades on, leather coat and pants, Yoko on her knees, like the famous Kent State photo where the girl can't shriek her boyfriend alive, her arms windmilling Ohio sky. A pump in John's chest heaves to mimic death throes. The blood is made of latex, his glasses broken on the plastic sidewalk. A scowling David Chapman, his arms outstretched, his pistol barrel spiraling fake smoke in a siren's red wash completes the composition, and somewhere background music plays Imagine before the tableau darkens. We push a button to renew the scream. The chest starts up again.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org and on our daily podcast, In the Moment Segments. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. Follow Lori on Twitter at @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thank you for listening.